Karima Brown, taking your calls on 011-883-0702.
8 minutes after nine coming up. This is the Karima Brown Show. And of course, you are listening to 702. Now, we continue to bring you more reaction. On the line now for this is Patrick Bond, Professor of Political Economy at the University of the Witwatersrand. Professor Bond, good evening. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Karima. Great to be with you and the listeners again. Thanks.
And then, of course, we also have economist Mr. Duma Kubule. He is the founding director at the Center for Economic Development and Transformation. Mr. Kubule, good evening. Welcome to the program.
Hey, good evening, Karima. How are you?
Well, thanks. Mr. Kubule, let me start with you. You wrote a piece in the Business Day saying Finance Minister Tito Mboweni could announce the biggest bailout of a state-owned company in South Africa's history on February 20th. Depending on the size of the debt, the restructuring and recapitalization package for Eskom, it could be up to 200 billion. The move could be creating some breathing room for the proper debate about the future of the ailing electricity producer. However, what the minister did do was that it gave Eskom another 150 billion over the next 10 years, but the government says it will not forgive the embattled power suppliers' debt and it must be repaid. What do you make of this move of Mr. Mboweni, Mr. Kubule?
Okay, first thing I should say is that there were two major challenges for the minister. The first one, he had to announce plans to revive the economy after a lost decade in terms of economic development. You remember that our economy has underperformed against the world economy, against developing countries over the past decade. And the number of unemployed people over the past decade has increased by 4 million people to 9.7. So we've got about 10 million unemployed people. So he had to revive the economy. The second thing, he had announced plans to fix the state-owned enterprises.
Yes.
Now, what he has announced, so now, if you look at the, I looked at the top 11 state-owned companies, and it's like your Eskom, Transnet, Telkom, SAA, and so forth. Now, the largest of them is Eskom.
Yeah.
Eskom accounts for about two-thirds of the debt of these state-owned enterprises and half of their revenue.
Mm.
So it's a very big organization. So, and you must remember that there's another 10 in addition to Eskom that are in dire straits, all of them.
And they are bankrupt, let's just be frank.
I was looking for the word, but now there's about three of them which are doing quite well, Telkom, Transnet, and AXA is doing pretty well. So the rest of them, 8 o'clock. So now what they've done is that they've announced 675 billion rand for these state-owned companies over the medium term, and 69 billion rand goes to Eskom, and 6 billion rand is for the other three to share, I mean the other 10 to share the 6 billion rand. Now, these companies, that many of them are on the verge of collapse, and it's not going to take, and then he's also announced the appointment of chief reorganization officers to lead the unbundling and fire sale of state assets. And I believe that these fire sales of state assets will not be enough to put them on the path to sustainability. And then the last point I want to make, Karima, is that on Valentine's Day, the president said, this is not a path to privatization.
Mm.
And today, Tito Mboweni virtually announced that there will be fire sales of state assets. So if you can't raise the money, your chief reorganization officer has to start fire sales of state assets to make up the difference.
Mm.
Now, you know that selling an asset is a long and complex issue. It can sometimes take, I believe that it should be done, but even on his terms, it can take 2 years, 3 years to sell the assets. As many of them have complained that they can't survive for even a few months.
Yes.
So the issue of this fire sale won't address the immediate issues that are facing these organizations. So what I noticed is the contradiction between what the president said and what the Minister of Finance said.
But this is historically what the ANC does, and it does it because there's a contestation going on in that organization. Duma, you and I are both aware of that. We are often at policy conversations where these contestations happen, and it often depends on the balance of power. Professor Patrick Bond, normally the kind of neoliberal approach to budgets are fiscal consolidation, austerity measures, and of course cutting the size of government. And we've heard the minister talking about the public wage bill having to be drastically reduced. We're talking about older people being phased out. And I put it to the Director General that whilst this might be a kind of elegant way of getting some people out and recouping money, in the case of Eskom, for example, where you have infrastructure that is 37 years old, if you're removing institutional memory because you're going to bring in cheaper, younger people, then you're kind of defeating the purpose of trying to fix that which needs to work for the long-term survival of the economy. Your take on the balancing act that Tito Mboweni did today?
Well, in general, thanks for having me, and also hello to Duma. I think it's a series of concessions that, as you say, reflect in an election year, a contested ANC, but also the old debate between austerity to basically shrink where a large budget deficit looms on the one hand, but Keynesianism on the other. That's the philosophy that if the private sector is very sick,
yes,
you actually do need to have state spending. This is actually a hidden tension, but there is a tradition in ANC that when, particularly the 2009 budget, if you go back to that, Pravin Gordhan ran, it was a very, very large deficit because the private sector that year was in a very serious recession. We lost a million jobs. And the interesting thing to me was that Mboweni didn't take the extreme position that his predecessor, Malusi, well, Mfantla Neni was temporary, but a year ago it was Malusi Gigaba offering a budget in which there were quite sharp cuts, including in very important areas like municipal infrastructure. And at the same time, what last year Malusi Gigaba did was gift very large amounts, in a sense, for exchange control liberalization so that rich people could and institutional investors could take money out. That's about 500 billion rand, a very large amount, because they relaxed from 75% to 70% the requirement that investors have to keep their money locally. Those, to me, were the two big things in last year's budget. And I was pleasantly surprised that even though it irritated the credit rating agencies no end, I mean, Mboweni said he had very difficult discussions with, especially Moody's, which holds that last potential junk rating on securities. That decision was a little bit more Keynesian. And it's maybe what you'd expect in an election year. He couldn't be too tough. He couldn't do mass firings. But and maybe very specifically the question you ask, because Eskom is very bloated at the top with a managerial elite, we may not notice if they are pushed out. The dilemma is whether the power stations we have, the coal-powered fired power stations, will continue to run. And there it's really a middle management, it's technicians, it's the ordinary workers on the line that I think are going to be much more important when maintenance and all these other decisions are taken. It's those guys that are carrying them out. So I wouldn't worry too much about a top layer, but certainly whether Eskom can use its 30,000 workers in a much more creative way becomes the question for the way forward.
All right, gentlemen, let's just take a listen to the finance minister speak about SOEs and the serious risk he says it poses to the fiscal framework.
The SOEs pose very serious risks to the fiscal framework. Funding requests from SAA, SABC, DINEL, Eskom, and other financially challenged state-owned enterprises have increased, with several requesting state support just to continue operating. Isn't it about time that the country asks itself the question, do we still need all these enterprises?
Of course, Duma, that's the quote that you were talking about, where you say that the finance minister differed quite substantially with the president. By that statement, he was virtually signaling that privatization is the way to go. But is that really true? Isn't he saying that we need to think out of the box, and we need to think that, I mean, we've been doing this thing around state-owned companies for years, and we've been getting exactly the same results. We've gotten a political elite that cannibalizes the organizations. We have them bankrupt. I mean, the SABC is literally going to run out of money to pay its staff in March. We know that because the former board chair told Parliament that, for example. What is it that needs to be done to re-look SOEs? Because they are the anchors through which the state intervenes in the economy. And there's been 100,000 processes to look where they belong, where they should go to line function. But I mean, we can't just raise the old argument. Surely we need fresh, out-of-the-box thinking, Duma.
Okay, so what he did say in addition to that clip, he said he doubled down on the whole issue of unbundling. And so he says that unbundling will allow for competition. So that's number one. Mm. And then he says the first step is to hive off a new transmission company, and then the transmission company will have strategic equity partners. That is privatization. And then he says that there will be cheap. When you give money to a state-owned enterprise, they'll have to put up a chief reorganization officer. I've never heard of what that thing. And then the conditions will be whatever money you get, you must also supplement it with asset sales. Mm. So those four or three issues, they, to me, are a direct contradiction to what the president was saying on Valentine's Day. Now, back to your question. SAA, Sanral is in a dire situation with 50 billion rands of debt. There was nothing that was said about that because, you know, partly because of the toll road issue.
Yeah, no, they just don't want to talk about e-tolls. It's an election year. It's a dangerous hot potato.
Yes, and then at the South African Post Office, SAA won't last for a few months. So there is no plan for those companies. We don't know what's going to happen. So I believe after the election, all these organizations, SABC, as you said, they're going to go back and announce massive job cuts. Now, in my analysis of these top state-owned enterprises, they employ 180,000 people. Mm. So we could see a massive job losses after the election. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, if one is getting to the question of job losses, I mean, yesterday the president and his cabinet committee met with the COSATU leadership around the issue of Eskom. I interviewed Becky and Charlie, Professor Patrick Bond, around the meeting. We couldn't get a response from the presidency. They referred us to Public Enterprises, and they were unable to comment because Minister Gordon was flying. But essentially what Begin Charlie and Charlie was saying was that they appreciate the national importance of Eskom to the country's economy. What they can't understand is why unbundling is the first option. But when I asked Mr. Charlie and Charlie to put an alternative on the table, he kind of stumbled. Do you have one?
Well, yes, it's a very simple one. A dramatic, just transition, which would shift Eskom from relying mostly on coal into renewable energy.
But how are you going to convince NUMSA, who positions itself as a party on the left, who's now forming a socialist revolutionary party to contest elections, who are saying that, you know, IPPs are actually the instrument of white monopoly capital. They are behaving like Luddites. I mean, they are like people who can see the fridge is already built, but still wants to drag ice in boxes and sell it to people. How are you going to get unions to actually buy into the fact that different kinds of jobs can be created, and they need to future-proof their workforce for that, and they, as a trade union, have responsibilities toward that. If you talk to people like Kusatu and NUMSA, they sing the same song. They just talk about the fact that there's going to be job losses because of the IPPs, but they're not prepared to embrace the future. I mean, it's not as if you can stop technology, and it's also not as if one can pretend that there isn't finite resources on our planet.
Right. I don't think they disagree with one word that you just said. It's a matter of whether it's an IPP, an independent power producer, with particularly European corporates that got a very generous price of over 2 rand per kilowatt hour. Those should be negotiated down to 80 cents, according to the current costings in the world market. But most, especially, Karima, most of what I hear from Kusatu is assessment of a just transition, which would be a state-owned renewable energy rollout, and not just that. You might have heard of the million climate jobs. It's sort of like what they're saying in the United States, a Green New Deal, coming from an agency in Cape Town called AIDC. Your listeners can go to aidc.org.za. And that just transition, which we hear about from President Ramaphosa, even in the State of the Nation, we hear about it from Energy Minister Jeff Khadebe, but we never see them do anything more than simplistic, pleasing rhetoric. This is where actually I would desperately hope that in getting out of coal, and especially questioning whether we should continue building Kusile, right, green people call for that to be stopped. But if you really listen to Urban Jim, and he's been very eloquent about this, although short-term they sound like Luddite because they're trying to defend coal-fired power plant jobs and mining jobs, they would love to see a state-owned enterprise that delivers renewable energy or more public transport or more compact cities or less commercial agriculture with pesticides. I think more than nearly any other union in the world, they put this very clearly in their statements, that a just transition that would ensure that good jobs go along with renewable energy.
Professor Patrick Bourne, I'm sorry, I don't buy that, because the detail is simply not there from the trade unions, and they have to accept that they are co-partners in this process. They are being consulted, they're being asked to put stuff on the table. We've got a situation where our power utility is in such a bad state, and we must remember it's in a bad state because of the way in which the ANC elite organized the relationship between Hitachi and Chancellor House when it decided on Kusile and Medupi, even though the rest of the world were building different kind of power stations. We were in the era of the biggest, the better, because, it was the age of Africa and all of the African Renaissance nonsense during Thabo Mbeki and a patriotic bourgeoisie. The truth of the matter is that we only have about 30 or 40% capacity on those stations, and they also have very serious design faults. The unions have done very little to protest state capture. When I interviewed NUM, they were actually saying that President Zuma was the best president because under him there were absolutely no job losses. Now, Duma, to what extent must the trade unions also come to the party and put workable alternatives on the table in terms of state-owned companies? We can start with Eskom. We can talk about the SABC. For example, in the case of the SABC, the Communication Workers Union actively colluded with Cloudy to strip the SABC of its finances. They enabled Minister Faith Mutambi to do what she did. We have a minister that just recently censored the SABC, put a hand in front of the camera, interfered in the work of the SABC, and she's going to have to go and negotiate that bailout. I mean, My sense is that no one actually has the language, the capacity, or even the conceptual understanding of what we need to do here.
Okay, now, first of all, I think we should say, Karima, that the president blindsided the unions by announcing out of the blue a plan to unbundle Eskom. Nobody saw it coming. I think it's unreasonable to expect them to already have an answer. But I've been reading a lot of responses from union people as to what they think should happen. And One of the things, as Patrick was saying, was that they're talking about a publicly owned option. So if you look at Eskom's cost base, half of it is renewable energy. Primary energy, which is renewables and coal. So what they're saying is that they don't want a for-profit delivery of IPPs. So what could happen is that you could have a natural state-owned natural resource company that will take ownership of the coal mines, especially the cost-plus mines, and get them at cost, the successful model of delivering coal, and also participate in the IPPs as well. So these are some of the options that are being put there. And then the second thing, when there are going to be job losses, it's not for the unions to come up with alternatives. The government must develop a proper outplacement program and resource it and make and manage the transition on behalf of the workers there. That's the first thing. And it will cost money as well for them to do a proper outplacement transition program, the just transition that everyone's talking about. And then the last thing is that the jobs that are being bandied about that are created on the renewables, they're measured in something called job years, which I can't understand. Some of them just don't make sense. Mm. They say 60,000 job years. I do not understand what that is. And if you say that is more people than are, It's like, sorry. So I've also looked at some of the stuff that they talk about, the IPP, for example, on enterprise development, black economic income, and the figures that they're banding about, they just don't make any sense whatsoever. So I think we should evaluate independently the impact that these IPPs are going to have as well.
Okay, that is a fair point to make, Duma. But Professor Bond, let me put this to you. When the Tegeta mine was being taken or bought by Eskom and done through a deal that basically stole money in order to buy a company to give us substandard coal. We didn't have a single union that marched onto that company and said, what the hell are you doing? We are not going to be able to actually provide electricity here. When Kusile and Medupi were simply not just delivering, we didn't have any union saying, why are we doing this when it is said it's not delivering on what needs to be delivered on? I mean, we have a social pact. Kusatu is in an alliance with the African National Congress. The sins of incumbency didn't just visit the African National Congress. It also visited unions. They, leaders of unions, were paid off by both Bosasa and by the Guptas. And who knows who else? If you look at the state of Popcrew, for example, with Bosasa and the death of someone like Vernie Peterson, who was the head of prisons, there has to be some accountability from the side of the trade unions in terms of the position that some of these state-owned companies find themselves in. There is just a refusal to accept that some of them actually benefited and participated in state capture and looted these organizations. In the case of the SABC, the role of the transport, the communications union is absolutely clear. I mean, their members are on the list of people who were illegally appointed, illegally given increases that cost the company close to 40 million rand. I mean, you can't just say government is responsible. It's impossible that it is only government that is responsible. Trade unions sit on many of these institutions, and many of these union leaders were the first that were bought over in the attempt to hollow out these institutions.
Fair enough. Everything you said is excellent analysis. But let's just take the nuance one step further. The obvious point is that this is actually one of the core reasons that Kusatu split, and that a large chunk, including the largest union, actually walked away from the privileges and the insiderness. So it's both excessive corruption. There's plenty of examples. You've given a few, even more. And it's also excessive loyalty to Zuma. And the National Union of Mine Workers was probably the most loyal of these. Yes, I cannot disagree with you, but you would agree, you watch these union politics as closely as anyone, that the resistance there meant the biggest union and ultimately 800,000 workers joined a competing federation, the South African Federation of Trade Unions, including Zwelinze Mavavi, the former leader of Kusatu, basically kicked out. Partly for these reasons, partly because they still oppose the neoliberal agenda. But if I might just come back, I also agree completely with your critique of why Medupi and Kusile are an outrage. And I would add only one other thing. It really broke my heart that Tito Mboweni is giving massive amounts of our tax budget, $23 billion a year this year, to pay interest on loans for which there should be lender liability. Don't forget, the biggest loan ever in World Bank history was from Madupi. And last year in the BRICS summit, we had the China Development Bank tossing another $2.5 billion U.S. dollars at Kusile. These are, as you said, design flaws and corrupt with the Hitachi Chancellor House. Would you not agree that lender liability should be raised? That Tito Mboweni, if he had any guts, would go to the World Bank, the $53 billion rand loan, $3.75 billion, and say, this actually should be on your books. And interestingly, a last quick point, the new World Bank president is about to be appointed, a man called David Malpass, the deputy finance minister in the U.S. You know, quite a rogue, an economist that Ernst didn't know was about to collapse. And I have no respect for him, but I do say that when he testified about why the World Bank was corrupt with corrupt lenders, corrupt borrowers, he specifically used the South Africa case. And it does seem to me, this was in his testimony in the U.S. Congress in late 2017, we should be following up on that as a citizenry and saying, actually, there's lender liability, the World Bank, you should give some debt relief, debt cancellation. Well, we should actually involve ourselves in a debt repudiation, much like the old Jubilee campaign. So I'd simply add to the point you're making with a bit more nuance. Does that make sense? You wouldn't disagree with me.
No, not at all. But my point is this, that when the trade unions engage with government, there is a sense that they cannot meet because their interests are completely divergent. And yet the reason why we have the problem in some of the institutions is in fact the collaboration of rogue elements, both within the state and in the governing party and in the unions. But the unions are refusing to take responsibility for that. The African National Congress is literally on trial at the Zondo Commission, whether it wants to accept it or not. All the nonsense is actually coming out. But the trade union federations are not prepared to accept their role in reducing some of these institutions to bankruptcy. And of course, we need to recover those monies. As you said, we need to have lender liabilities. So why don't we, for example, have lender liabilities in terms of Tegeta? Why don't we have lender liabilities? Why are the trade unions not marching onto McKinsey, marching onto KPMG, the private institutions that actually enabled state capture together with rogue elements, both in the union movements and in government, Duma?
You know what? I can't disagree with anything that you said. I don't remember seeing any marches on Tegeta or McKinsey or KPMG. And as Patrick was saying, there was a lot of, as you were saying, at SABC, that's the one I know about. There were, and also in the transport sector, there were different unions on the different sides of these debates. And what happened at SABC, I know a little bit about it. I don't know too much. It was actually horrible what happened and the position that the union took at the SABC as well. Yeah. So they should be accountable for part of the mess that happened at the SABC.
Precisely, which means, of course, that when we get into a social compact, as we should in South Africa, there has to be a give and take. And government has come with its proposal, and you correctly say that unions were slightly blindsided. But, you know, up until today, Professor Bond, I've asked Zwelin Zimavavi, instead of the 20 rand that was proposed as the national minimum wage in NEDLAC, they are not able to come up with a figure. 3 years of research went into the work of that commission. The act doesn't necessarily reflect exactly what was agreed to at that negotiations, but someone like Neil Coleman, for example, put in the time, put in the effort, and actually came to the party. What I'm trying to get to is that these ideological debates, for the sake of it, takes us nowhere, Duma. We need to grow our economy. We need to create jobs. We need to get out of our entrenched ways of thinking. How do we do that when one doesn't want to acknowledge your own role in the mess that has actually been created?
Yes, everything you're saying is correct. I think the people who are involved, they must acknowledge the role. But now let's talk about the solutions.
And yes.
I do think the unions are putting solutions, especially on the issue of ESCOM, but it's literally 2 weeks since the whole announcement was made, and I hope that they are investing in coming up with alternatives. But what they were saying in that is that the trend globally is not to unbundle. Mm. The trend is to rebundle. The trend is now you've seen in the United Kingdom, the Labour Party, they're calling for the renationalization of the utilities, like your energy, your water, and so forth, because they've seen the chaos and instability that is caused by these liberalized markets for utilities. Yeah. So I just think that we have to have a proper debate, and this is what I was saying, is that we need to have a formal mechanism for consultation around this thing of ESCOM. And because you remember, like, there was that press conference literally at the end of November.
Yes.
The government didn't have a clue what they wanted to do with ESCOM.
Yeah.
And then 2 months later, they suddenly have a plan. It has to be suspicious.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we've got last question. Professor Bond, the issue around solutions are critical. And increasingly, we have compacts where people serve on boards, where you take different interests into consideration. What is the one thing that is required for the trust chasm that has built up between these individuals as they're negotiating that needs to be crossed for us to have a honest debate, as Duma say, about actual solutions and look at the long-term and sustainable solutions for state-owned companies one way or the other? Because even though Tito Mboweni said whether we keep, he didn't just say we should ask whether we should have them. He said, if we keep them, what do we do with them? And how do you get people to think about that when no one trusts each other? Because that is the difficulty at the moment.
That's right, because there's just been so much corruption. So if there's one simple word that could take us further, it seems to me it is insourcing. And the reason I say insourcing, I work at a university that made a mistake of outsourcing a large number of workers. So lots of protests. Now we've insourced them and they at least have a living wage. And the procurement fraud in the budget, according to Kenneth Brown, who 2 years ago had to resign as Treasury's procurement officer because of death threats, his estimate is that 35% to 40% of our procurement budget is overcharging by corporates. That's the profound lack of trust when you do these outsourcing and IPPs and PPPs. It's truly public-private pilfering. This is the way we should understand the tendency to outsource. And the tragedy is that, although this was mentioned, well, very clearly by Kenneth Brown, that's 240 billion rand a year in fraud on about a 600 billion rand a year procurement budget.
And of course, the irony of all of this is that it is done by a party that continues to argue that the state needs to lead these institutions. And I'm afraid that the state can't even roll out Panado if it wanted to tomorrow. So I'm really worried about a whole statist approach, simply because what we've put in the state's hands has often led to absolute bankruptcy. So I'm not quite sure whether the state
is of tenderpreneurs.
Yes, but it actually works off the back of the very unions that are there. If you look at the pilfering in hospitals, the stealing of blankets, the stealing of linen, etc., that has to happen with the say so of unions like Nehao. They are never held accountable. The corruption in prisons, Pop Crew, never held accountable. And what I'm trying to suggest here is that we need to have an honest conversation about the nature of the problem. We have a capitalist economy that breeds corruption. And it isn't, it's an equal opportunity bastard. It goes for state employees and for unionists. And I don't think that our labor movement has really come to terms with what that means. But this is a conversation that we will have for another time. We need to
Just 10 seconds. We have a counterexample, which is Treatment Action Campaign forcing the hospitals to give publicly supplied generic medicines. 7 million people are HIV positive. 5 million get these. The life expectancy went from 52 to 64. that was through the state because you had very good civil society activists.
Exactly. It wasn't just left to the state. That is my entire point. Thank you for making it, Professor Bond. Duma Qubule, thank you so very much. Economist and founding director at the Center for Economic Development. And of course, also Professor Bond, who is the professor of political economy at the University of the Witwatersrand. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we take a gendered look at the budget and what is in it for women.